I am Joanna, and this is my story. When I graduated high school and I started doing my own thing and seeking Christ on my own, I promised myself, especially since I was attending college, I promised myself I wasn't going to focus on boys and it was just going to be me and God. And then there then came this boy, and a couple months down the road, we started dating. I went on spring break to West Virginia, and while I was gone, he cut ties with me. He cut all communication off from me, and I was like, what went wrong? I started walking away from Christ, and I didn't even realize that I was walking away from Christ. I then started indulging in bad habits, like smoking and drinking. Ended up giving myself to a man who just counted me as another number. It went on for the rest of the summer. It's about when him and I reconnected, the guy that had broken up with me over spring break. I was telling myself, well, maybe there's still a chance. Looking back on it now, I see that God was trying to pull me out of this relationship with this guy in this situation, but I ignored what God was trying to tell me and show me. So one of my girlfriends said, fear is saying you don't trust God. Fear, worry. So I surrendered it. And it was just like, it was within an instant that she sent me that text. It was just like, it was just gone. That was like fall, winter of last year. So she said that, and I started picking myself back up again, but I was still connected to this toxic relationship. And I really was so excited for Christ, but I was still hiding something and running from something. Even if it wasn't God, I was still hiding something and running from something and keeping something from God and not letting him handle this one tiny little thing. The drinking and smoking continued, and like leading up to New Year's Day, I was so wasted. I ended up passing out on the bathroom floor. The next morning, I wake up, I'm more sober. New Year's Day, I decided I'm done drinking. I'm done drinking and using it as a coping mechanism to hide my problems. That same day, I walked away from that bad relationship. I deleted him off of all social media. I walked away, didn't talk to him, no interaction whatsoever. Instantly, like, days go on and they feel empty. But at least it's kind of a healthy emptiness. It left room and space for someone else to come and fill. I've finally forgiven the boy that hurt me and that I was holding on to anger and confusion over. So where I'm at right now in my walk with Christ is I'm still learning. I'm still a baby. I'm in a much healthier place spiritually and within myself, and I'm so much stronger within my faith too.
Anna is a part of our community, and I just really appreciated greatly her courage and sharing a glimpse of her story, and that is really just a glimpse, yeah. And part of the reason I was excited that she was willing to share some of that story is because it connects so intimately to what we are going to talk about today. But hopefully, especially for those of you that are newer to this community, just You just need to know we're a pretty raw and authentic community, and I mean, it's one of the great parts being about a church plant and a startup, and we're only 14, 15 months into this, so we don't know any better than to pretend and hide and be something better than where we really are, and this is who we are, and this just ties and just brings to light how relevant the scripture is to our life, because Joanna's not alone in her story and the things that we go after in our lives to try and to escape or run from something. And we're in this series, David. This is week two of this series, and today we're going to talk about something that is just common to all of us and relevant to every single one of us, either in this season of your life or certainly in the future, sometime in the future. That we're going to talk about it today because ultimately, you may not be aware, but our mission and the reason we launched this community was to help you, to help everyone that we can become and be truly fully devoted followers of Jesus. And if you're skeptical or you're not sure about Jesus, I get it. In fact, one of the challenges that we're going to discover this morning when it comes to following Jesus or when it comes to trusting God and putting our trust in God is that the ways of God feel and seem most unappealing and seemingly irrelevant when we are angry or isolated or afraid. Whether you're a Christian or maybe you just have a concept of God or you're a theist in general, however you would define that, the ways of God, the way that you view God, the ways of God are most unappealing and most irrelevant when we feel angry or when we feel isolated or alone or lonely. We feel afraid. And these three conditions, as many of us have already discovered, these three conditions have the potential to undermine the resolve of even the most dedicated, devout, disciplined person among us. When we feel these things, we have the potential to just to blow through these things. These three conditions have the potential to cause us to crash through every moral and ethical boundary that we set up for ourselves, the guardrails that we set up for ourselves relationally, physically, financially, and even professionally. That, in fact, if you were to stand up and say, I want to tell you the greatest regret of my life, chances are it was a regret, it was a decision that you made, something that you said during a time, a moment, a season when you felt angry or you felt isolated or you felt afraid. And you did something or you said something that you deeply regret. And unfortunately, one of these three things will probably be a part of one of your future regrets as well. Because when we're overwhelmed with the emotions associated with any of these three conditions, we feel compelled to do something. I've got to do something, to relieve this tension, relieve this anxiety, to alleviate this fear. In fact, you'll do almost anything. We look back and we're surprised, and oftentimes we do the wrong thing. We do what comes natural, and as a result, things don't get better, they get worse. There's not less regret, there's more regret. Things aren't less complicated. We make our own lives more complicated. And then we find ourselves angrier, more lonely, more scared, more afraid. Now, to the story of David, most of us know that David had a colossal failure in his life, but he actually had two colossal failures in his life. One he's famous for that actually happened in his 50s when he had already become king, but the one that we're going to talk about today actually happened when he was 22. So he's not king yet. Following his defeat of Goliath, and if you didn't hear last week's message, please, please go to newlifewichita.com. You can listen, you can download it, whatever, but you need to get caught up. Last week, we followed David into the Valley of Elah, and he goes down there, and he faced Goliath, and he kills Goliath. And in that moment, he becomes the most famous person in the entire nation, and he was 15 years old. At 15 years old, everyone knew his name, and they're writing songs about David. He's become a legend, and King Saul, who was Israel's first king, he was extraordinarily insecure. So he sees this young man, sees that he's got a lot of potential, but also that overnight, he has all of a sudden garnered great influence and great power. So King Saul came up with a plan. He decided to get David into his family so that he could control him. He offers one of his daughters in marriage to David, but David, his response is so amazing. He's like, who am I to be the son-in-law of the king? Like, this is no small thing. I'm not worthy. I don't come from a noble family or a wealthy family. And then, of course, everybody else is like, oh my gosh. I mean, this guy is amazing. What an amazing kid. He's 15. Who would turn down such an offer from the king? But David is in love with one of King Saul's other daughters named Michal, apparently a good girl's name back then. So Saul sets up this impossible mission, And if he can accomplish this impossible mission, then he has earned the right to have his daughter in marriage. Well, David is successful. They get married. Then he becomes best friends with King Saul's son, Jonathan. And so now suddenly Saul realizes that getting this kid into my family, actually, it was a really bad idea, because he just has become more powerful. He's more loved. Now he's deeply loved by those people that are closest to me. And King Saul becomes very, very jealous. So time goes by for about 7 years. And so David finds himself in King Saul's favor, out of King Saul's favor. He's in his favor, out of his favor, out of favor, back and forth. You got to read it for yourself. Finally, Saul's like, you know what? I got to get rid of this kid, but because the people love him, I can't lay a hand on him, so I'm going to let the Philistines do it. And so he sends him on mission after mission, these impossible missions against the Philistines. And every single time, David comes back alive and victorious, which just makes his fame and his popularity and the love that people have for him just grow more and more. And he discovers that. King Saul discovers that. Every time he tries to have David secretly arrested, his own son, Jonathan, or his own daughter, whom David married, works behind his back ultimately to keep him from being arrested. And the frustration just builds and builds and builds. And finally, it just culminates one night at dinner. Now, if you ate at the king's table, this was an extraordinary honor. And David had typically shown up for dinner, but during these turbulent years, David had been missing dinner more and more often. And then King Saul would say to his son, Jonathan, hey, where's David? And Jonathan was always covering for David. Well, I think he's doing this. I think he's doing that. And so he's covering. And so one night, the whole family's gathered, and King Saul just loses it. He just explodes. And here's what the text tells us. Saul's anger flared up at Jonathan, and he said to him, "You son of a perverse and rebellious woman." It's like, whoa. It's like, maybe we shouldn't give children their Bible. And hopefully the perverse and rebellious woman wasn't at the table. This would have been awkward. "You son of a perverse and rebellious woman, you, don't I know that you have sided with the son of Jesse to your own shame and to the shame? Is she here at the table, the mother who bore you?" So apparently the honeymoon was over between Saul and Jonathan's mom. So he goes on, "As long as the son of Jesse lives on this earth," and this was the real issue, "neither you nor your kingdom," because Jonathan was the king's son. And so he saw Jonathan as the future king. And Saul, insecure Saul, definitely wants his legacy to live on. "Neither you nor your kingdom will be established. Now send someone to bring him to me. He must die." And then he storms out of the room. Well, Jonathan goes, and again, it's an amazing story. You need to read it for yourself. But Jonathan goes, he finds David, and he says, "David, you got to run. You got to disappear. My father is not going to rest until you are dead." And so he's just too threatened by your reputation, your influence on this nation. David was 22 years old when this happened. And suddenly, David and Goliath, David is afraid for his life. He's alone. And he's rejected by the man that he's risked his life for over and over again. He feels rejected by the nation that he's risked his life for over and over again. And in this case, he's done nothing wrong. So he feels abandoned. He is angry. He's afraid. And he did what many of us do when we feel abandoned, angry, or afraid. He panicked. He lost sight of something. And he decided to take matters into his own hands. Anointed by Samuel, David and Goliath, David. He lost sight of the fact that God was with him. And see, it's so easy for us to be critical of David because we've got the 30,000 foot view. We know how the story ends. We know the details. It's like, why, David? Why would you make a decision like that? Why would you panic? Why would you run? Why would you abandon your morals and abandon your ethics? But here's the thing. I can't help but think that there may be people who are watching you right now. People that are watching us right now. And as we struggle to maybe handle these same feelings of feeling alone or feeling angry or feeling afraid, and they look at us and they wonder the same thing. Why would you do that? In fact, let's be honest, and you don't even have to be a Christian or a religious person to play this game. You can look back on a season of your own life. You look back on a season of your own life, and now that you've had some time and context, you ask yourself, what was I thinking? Why did I make that decision? Why did I do that? Why did I say those words? Why did I call him back? Why did I go there? Why did I say yes to that opportunity? Why did I spend that money? Why did I borrow that money and accrue more debt? Why didn't I just get up and move? Why didn't I just run away? Or why did I just run away? And the answer is simple. When you feel abandoned, angry, or afraid, our natural inclination is to panic. And that's exactly what David did. The text tells us David went to Nob, to Ahimelech the priest. Now, at this time in history, Jerusalem was not a part of the nation of Israel. They didn't like own it. And so there wasn't really a capital city of Jerusalem, a capital city for the Jewish nation. So the epicenter of Jewish worship was wherever the tabernacle and the Ark of the Covenant was. So it actually moved from city to city. It would move to the safest territory that was under the control of the nation of Israel. And at this particular time, it was in the city of Nob, so the tabernacle and the Ark of the Covenant. So as a result, the high priest and all the other priests were there, and the high priest was Ahimelech at that time. So when David shows up, we're told Ahimelech trembled when he met him. And he asked him, why are you alone? Why is no one with you? Now, why did he ask this? Because here's the deal. Wherever David went, you knew he was coming before he got there. David traveled with 1,000 personal warriors anywhere he went. And Ahimelech had just never seen David by himself. And suddenly, David shows up alone. He looks a little disheveled. He looks a little bit nervous. And Ahimelech's just a little freaked out. He's like, what's going on? Why are you alone? And David lies. Now, here's the thing. This is where David's story intersects with ours. David is against lying. I mean, it's like one of the top 10 thou shalt nots, right? And he's a Jewish man. He believes in God. He's a man who loves God. He's a man who writes about God. He's a man who writes songs about God. He's against lying, but David lies. Why? Because he's afraid. And when you're afraid, when you're angry, and you feel abandoned, when you feel isolated so much for the ways of God. And David answered Ahimelech the priest, "The king sent me on a mission and said to me, 'No one is to know anything about this mission that I'm sending you on.'" So the reason why, I'm on a secret mission. "As for my men," and I'm not really alone. It just looks like I'm alone. "I've told them to go meet me in a certain place." See, he didn't have any men. He's afraid. And he's afraid that if he tells Ahimelech the truth, Ahimelech will not help him. And that lie would cost not David. That lie of David would cost Ahimelech and his entire family, their lives. So the story continues. David says, "What do you have on hand? Give me 5 loaves of bread or whatever you can find." And Ahimelech's thinking, this doesn't make sense. This is the king's son-in-law, the captain of the bodyguard. He shows up alone. He's here without any food, no weapon. He's on a secret mission, and his men are hiding somewhere. But the priest answered David, "I don't have any ordinary bread on hand. However, there is some consecrated bread here." So to give context, every Sabbath, the priest would bake bread, and they would go and they would place it on an altar before the Lord. And this sounds kind of strange to us, but this was their way, one of the ways of honoring God. And then no surprise, they would come in back in the next day, and behold, God had not eaten the bread. So they would take the bread, the priest would keep it, they would eat it, but the thing is, it was consecrated bread. So you had to be ceremonially clean to eat the bread. So Ahimelech is basically saying, we don't have any normal food here because we're priests, but we have consecrated bread, and if you want it, you can have it. And so the priest gave him the consecrated bread. Now David has not only lied about why he's there, but now he's lied so that he can be fed. Which, if you heard the first part of the series, seriously, you have to begin to wonder, where is the, "In you, my Lord, I put my trust, my hope is in you all day long." Where's that version of David? What happened to the, "God, you are my refuge. I run to you in times of trouble"? What happened to that version of David? And then what happens next? I'm just telling you, we can read through it and just blast right past it. There is so much drama and tension in this next part, but we miss it. But I'm hoping that the drama in this next moment will speak to you, either where you're at now or where you will be in the future. David asked Ahimelech, "Do you have a spear or a sword here?" "I haven't brought my sword or any other weapon because the king's mission was so urgent." I'm just telling you, in this moment, David was virtually transported back in time to the very event that God used to catapult him into fame. This is the wake-up call moment. This is the, oh my gosh, what am I thinking? Oh my gosh, what am I doing? Why am I thinking this way? Why am I doing this? This was the moment that his eyes should have been open. The priest replied, "The sword of Goliath, the Philistine whom you killed just 7 years ago, David, in the Valley of Elah, it's here." The text tells us that when David beheaded Goliath, he took Goliath's sword as a souvenir, which, of course, who wouldn't, right? But later he dedicated it to God and he gave it to the high priest. It was basically a way of saying, and just like symbolic of God, on that day, I did not save myself. You're the one that saved me. You're the one that rescued me. And so I'm giving this back as a show of that I have been dependent on you. And there was just so much emotion, so much significance around the sword of Goliath. And suddenly, David is reminded of the afternoon that he did the unthinkable. I mean, again, can you imagine this moment? The priest brings out the sword, David looks at it, and in that moment, all of these memories come flooding back into his mind. The afternoon that he wandered down into the Valley of Elah, all by himself, 15 years old, as an unarmed shepherd boy, nothing but a sling. There are thousands of men on the ridge to his left, thousands of men on the ridge to his right. They're all eyes are on him. What happened to that clear-eyed, courageous, God-trusting shepherd boy who looked a giant, battle-hardened warrior in the eye and said, "You come to me with sword and spear, but I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied. Today I'm going to kill you, I'm going to cut off your head, and I'm going to feed the carcasses of the entire Philistine army to the birds of the air and the beasts of the field, so that the whole world will know there is a God in Israel. And all of these thousands to my left and to my right, all of these gathered here today will know that it is not by what? Sword or spear that the Lord saves. For the battle is the Lord's, and he will give all of you into our hands." What happened to that kid? What happened to the kid that ran towards danger instead of away from it? And then he saw so clearly that it's not by sword or spear that the Lord saves, and yet now he's asking for a sword or a spear. What happened to the poet who wrote these famous words, I will fear no evil, for thou art with me"? Where is that kid? Where is that faith? Where is that confidence in God? And the answer is simple. Fear, anger, loneliness, we know this. These three giants have the potential to cause us to forget all of the defeated giants of the past. These three giants have the potential to undermine our faith in God. Faith in a God that is based on the victories done in the past. And David gets this extraordinary visual aid right in front of him, a reminder of God's faithfulness and God's power, but he totally misses it. The priest replied, "The sword of Goliath, the Philistine whom you killed in the Valley of Elah is here. It is wrapped in a cloth behind the ephod, which is the garment that the priests wore when they were doing their priestly duties. If you want it, take it. There's no sword here but that one." All the memories, all the drama. And Ahimelech, he's thinking, none of this makes sense to me. And then David says, "There's none like it. Give it to me." And this would be the decision that David would regret for the rest of his life. And like all of our decisions do, it would become a permanent part of his life's story. David takes matters literally into his own hands. He lies, and then he runs away with a sword that was last wielded by a warrior that David, as a 15-year-old boy, had killed. He should have seen it. He should have remembered. It was just so obvious. It was too much to miss. But this, again, is where our stories intersect with David's. Because when we need God the most, oftentimes we are least apt to lean in his direction. When we need God the most, we're oftentimes too tempted to run away rather than run towards. We opt for things that often lead to regret. And here's what's amazing, and this is just as true of me as it is of you. It is so easy to see this in other people, right? I mean, you've got friends, you've got family, and you've got coworkers right now, and they're making terrible decisions based on anger or fear or sense of being abandoned, isolated, alone, however that fits in. You see it, and you're thinking, you're just going to make your life more complicated. You're just going to create more regret. It is so easy to see it in other people. It is almost impossible to see it in the mirror. Why? Because we convince ourselves that we're the exception. We convince ourselves that our story is unique and different. And you just see this, and we think what David thought. If God was really with me, this wouldn't be happening to me. We think if God were really with me, this wouldn't be happening to me. Because here's the deal. Here's something perhaps we've all experienced. It's easy to trust God when there's nothing to trust him with and nothing to trust him for. It's so easy in the early days when there's just nothing to trust God. You know, maybe you're young. You're like 12 or 15. Like, God, I want to know your will for my life. I'll do whatever you want to do. I surrender my life. Everything I have, I give to you. And God's like, you know, that's great. You know, you're like 15, so you got like the stuff in your room. You got a car. It's not even yours. But okay, I'll take it. You know, it's just easy. You know, but the point is, when things are going great, how difficult is it to sing the songs? When things are going great, how difficult is it to show up and serve? When things are going great, how difficult is it to pray the prayers to God and pray for people that are going through difficult times and for friends and family? It's easy to trust God when we have nothing to trust him with and nothing to trust him for. But it is harder. It's harder to trust God when things that we value begin to slip away. And to show you where this goes, and again, it can be so easy for us to be critical of David, but we have our own version of this story, right? He takes Goliath's sword and he decides to leave the country. Guess where he goes? To the Philistines. Man of genius. So he shows up in the land of the Philistines with Goliath's sword. And not only that, but things get worse. He goes to the city of Gath. Guess who was from the city of Gath? Goliath. See, this is why we can believe this actually happened, because nobody would make this up because it's ridiculous. But he's panicking. He's afraid. And so he goes to the leader of the Philistines and says, hey, I want to join your army. I will help you. I'll fight against my own people. But they're not buying it. They're like, no. You're David. Don't tell us you're not. Everybody knows who you are. You slew Goliath. In fact, you're carrying his sword. All right, so we know who you are. And then David becomes really, really afraid because now he's surrounded by his enemies. So what does he do? He pretends like he's insane, literally. Like he starts running around. He's like digging at wood with his fingernails. He starts slobbering all over his beard, acting like a madman. I'm telling you, you should read the Bible. It's all here. So he starts slobbering all over himself. And the king's like, I got enough fools in my court. I don't need this fool. He needs to leave. So get this guy out of here. So David flees. He's 22 years old. And he flees to a cave because he doesn't know what to do. He feels abandoned by God. He doesn't know what to do, and he's angry. He doesn't deserve this, and he's alone, and he's afraid. And finally, and maybe this is your moment, finally he comes to his senses. He goes back to his country. He finds another prophet, and he goes to the prophet. He says, I've really messed up. I want to know what God's will is for me. I don't know the Lord's will. Will you seek the Lord's will on my behalf? Will you provide for me the will, the counsel of God? And this is great, but the problem is the damage has already been done and cannot be undone. See, when David was with Ahimelech the high priest, when he was looking for bread or weapon, there was another fellow there named Doeg. And Doeg was actually the chief shepherd of Saul's flocks. And so he's there. He overhears parts of the conversation. He's able to hear just enough that he actually gets like the truth and what's not truth a little bit mixed up, a little bit confused to make things look really bad for Ahimelech. So he goes to King Saul. He's like, I have located David for you, but King Saul, I've got a little bad news. He has sided with your enemy. Doeg tells King Saul, Ahimelech inquired of the Lord for him. In other words, that David showed up and Ahimelech went to God to get advice for him, which actually wasn't true. He also gave him provisions. And I hate to tell you this, he gave him the sword of Goliath, the Philistine. In other words, this priest, Ahimelech, he fed him and he armed him. And Saul is furious. The text says, the king sent for the priest Ahimelech. Go to Nob, bring him all the men of his family who were priests, the priests at Nob, and they all came to the king. And King Saul said to them, why have you conspired against me, you and the son of Jesse, giving him bread and a sword and inquiring of God for him? In other words, you're in on this. My son's in on it. My daughter's in on it. My family's in on it. Now my chief priest is against me. So that he's rebelled against me. And he lies in wait for me as he does today. But Ahimelech's like, what? Ahimelech answered, who of all your servants is as loyal as David? He's like, what are you talking about? David isn't in rebellion against you. He's like your most loyal subject. He's the king's son-in-law, the captain of the king's bodyguard. He's saying, you've entrusted your life to this guy. And he's highly respected in your household. And he says, was this day the first time I inquired of God for him? Of course not. Let not the king accuse your servant or any of his father's family. For I don't know anything about this. For your servant knows nothing about this whole affair. But the king said, you will surely die, Ahimelech. You and your whole family. Because he's crazy. He's paranoid. And he feels abandoned and angry and afraid. And the king did something really foolish. Then he ordered his guards at his side, turn and kill the priests of the Lord, because they too have sided with David. And there's a part of me that loves this little part right here. The warriors that traveled with King Saul refused to kill the priest. Like, we'll kill your enemies, we'll even kill prisoners of war, but we're not laying a hand on these men. But Doeg, dirtbag Doeg, chief herdsman, he thinks this is an opportunity to get good with the king. He raises his hand and says, if they won't do it, I will. And he kills 85 men with the sword. But Saul's not finished. He says, now, I want all of you to go to Nob. I want you to kill every man, every woman, every child, and every infant. And very few escape the massacre. One of Ahimelech's sons gets away. And somehow he finds David, he falls at his feet, and he tells David the entire story, and David is broken. The text tells us, I am responsible for the death of your entire family. David was responsible for the death of an entire village, because when you're angry or you feel isolated or afraid, taking matters into your own hands in a moment feels good. It just doesn't turn out good in the end. And most often, not only do we get hurt when we react out of those feelings, but the people closest to us or other people, there is collateral damage in the lives of others as well. Now, we're going to pick up the story of David next week. But as we wrap up this morning, I just want to ask a few questions and just to think about how this intersects with our lives as you leave here today, because we're not just about teaching information. It's about, okay, what do we do with this? How do I apply this? If you unapplied truth is irrelevant, right? So here's just a few questions, because there's going to be a time in all of our lives. There's going to be a time in all of our lives where a moment or a season of anger pushes us to say or do things that we shouldn't. Or we will have a season, whether you're single or married, because I'm telling you, you can almost feel more isolated in a marriage than you can single sometimes. I'm just warning you. So here's the thing. We're going to face these moments where we feel isolation or loneliness, and suddenly we're fantasizing about things that we would tell other people they have no business even considering, let alone doing. Things that are somehow now live options for us because the emotions are so powerful. So here's the question. What is your loneliness, anger, or fear causing you to consider that you've never considered before? Relationally, financially, physically. Some sort of risk you'd never have taken before. Maybe it's the idea of re-embracing an old habit that you spent hours or weeks or months or maybe even years, maybe even thousands of dollars to break from, and suddenly you find yourself thinking about re-embracing an old habit. What is your loneliness or anger or fear causing you to consider that you never considered before or to reconsider? And have you ever seen that actually work out for anybody? How about this question? Who is your loneliness, anger, or fear causing you to consider that you shouldn't consider? It's like you've never called them back. chosen not to call him back, but you're thinking about calling him back now. You never called her back, but you're thinking about it. Or she's made it obvious, or he's made it obvious through a text, through a message, through a note, through something that they've said, that they've communicated that there's a potential for a relationship between the two of you, and yeah, it may cross some lines. And you've ignored it, but because of what's going on in your home or your current relationship or your circumstances, you're thinking about it. Suddenly it's becoming a live option, and you know you have no business doing that. There's financial decision that maybe you've never considered before that you would tell somebody else, no, run, flee, don't ever do something like that. But because of what's going on in your financial circumstances, suddenly for you it's become a viable option in your mind. And here's the wake-up call for question for every single one of us, because if those first questions don't do it for us, hopefully this is the one. This is the wake-up call question. This is the one that David completely missed, but it's a wake-up call question for every one of us now and in the future. And the question is, who besides you, who besides you do your considerations put at risk? Who besides you do these options that were never options before, but suddenly in your mind, now they're viable options. These are things I could do. Who do those options put at risk besides you? And I'll go ahead and answer the question for you. It's the people that you love the most and the people that love you the most. Some of you, you know this through personal experience. Maybe it was with your family growing up because dad felt isolated or alone in his marriage, and so he gave in to his appetite for another woman. Or his anger spun out of control, or his fear of never having enough led him to just abandon you while he gave himself to his career. And you've been dealing with the aftermath of that ever since. Mom's depression or mom's sense of loneliness or abandonment just got out of control and she turned to other things or another man. And you've been dealing with that ever since as a son or a daughter. Or for some of you, perhaps, you've just experienced this personally because, again, you look back and there was that moment or that season that you just gave in to your frustration or your anger or your abandonment or your fear, and you saw the collateral damage on their face. You've seen it. But that doesn't mean that we have to continue that pattern. We can stop. And ask, who else's future hangs in the balance of my personal decision to give into this impulse caused by anger or abandonment or fear? And just a last one. What advice would you give someone who's you? What would you tell yourself? Because again, isn't it true when it's someone else, it is so clear. I mean, we're just geniuses with everybody else's life. But when it comes to ours, it is a fog, right? We think we're the exception to the rule. Well, here's your takeaway today. You are not. You are not an exception to the rule. You're a unique person, but your experience is not unique. You're a one-of-a-kind person, but your experience is not one-of-a-kind. These are well-worn paths, which is why we know so easily for other people what they should do. And we know the advice that David would give us, not 22-year-old David, but grown-up David. Here's what he would write later. The Lord is a refuge for the oppressed. The Lord, not a chemical, not alcohol, not an affair, not another person, not a lot of debt, not in a new car, not a new house, not a new whatever it is that you could put on a list. The Lord is a refuge, a stronghold in times of trouble. Now, this is a word we don't really get in our culture, the word stronghold, at least not till Lord of the Rings. But a stronghold is a place where you would flee to in times of war, bar the gates, and be safe in times of trouble, the place you would run to. David would say, God is the place you run to. God is the person that you run to in times of trouble. David would say, I took my refuge in me. I took my refuge in my ability to try and control outcomes, and it was a disaster. He later wrote, those who know your name, God, trust in you, for you, Lord, have never forsaken those who seek you. I thought this wouldn't be happening to me if God was with me. I thought this wouldn't be happening to me if God was with me. But now I look back and I realize God was with me. I felt forsaken, but I was mistaken. Don't make the same mistake. That's what he would say to us. And then here's something for those of you that may be skeptical about Christianity, just to consider that 1,000 years later, a descendant of David in the city of David would look into the eyes of some frightened, angry, abandoned, overtaxed Israelites, and he would say, "Come to me." Instead of the Lord as a refuge, Jesus would look at these people a thousand years later and say to a group of people in the very same part of the world, "Come to me. Come to me, all you who are weary and burdened, and I'll give you rest. So, and take my yoke upon you. My perspective, my worldview, take my yoke on you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart." And then he speaks to what all of us, what we really, really want. "And you will find rest for your souls. Because when you feel forsaken, you're mistaken, God is with you." And that's what Jesus would say. That's what David would tell us. The Lord is a refuge for the oppressed. He's your stronghold in times of trouble. So I want to invite the band up, because I asked them if they would practice and sing this song this morning, introduce us to this song. You're welcome to just sit and listen, just kind of take the words in, take it in. You know, if somewhere in there you feel like, "Man, I want to sing this. I think I got it. I can do this." But I love the lyrics. "Promise maker, promise keeper, you finish what you begin. Our provision through the desert, you see it through to the end. The Lord our God is ever faithful, never changing through the ages. From this darkness you will lead us, and forever we will say, you're the Lord our God. In silence, in the waiting, still we can know you are good. All your plans are for your glory. Yes, we can know you are good. The Lord our God is ever faithful, never changing through the ages. From this darkness you will lead us, and forever we will say, you're the Lord our God. We won't move without you. You're the light of all and all that we need. We won't move without you." Let's pray. Father, in this room, or those that are listening right now online, God, in our lives, there, in a group this size, easily there are several of us that are dealing with feelings of isolation or loneliness. Maybe feeling angry or frustrated about our circumstances or something that we're dealing with and just seems to stick and have a grip on us. Or we're afraid. We're afraid about the future. We're afraid about a circumstance. We can't see how something is about to play out. We can't see 2 steps ahead of us, let alone days or weeks or months. And Father, I just pray for those of us that are in this room, those who are listening, God, truly that we would walk away from this. And even though the circumstances may not have changed, we will have changed, because we'll sense your presence. We'll sense your love. We will sense that the world is not spinning out of control, because you are the one that has the world and all of the outcomes in your hand, and that you are trustworthy. You have our best interest in mind, and that you will walk with us through whatever that circumstance is. That may be short, it may be long, but that you are with us and that we can put our hope in you all day long. So Father, I just pray that over everyone in this room, everyone that's listening, that God, that they would walk out with just feeling that assurance that they are not alone. It's in the name of Jesus that I pray. Amen.